This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We are waiting now almost by the moment to find out more about what is happening in Afghanistan in particular as Americans are being evacuated from Kabul. But how about all of the efforts that have been trying to, in the recent weeks certainly, and up to the decision to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, getting interpreters and their family members out? A number of veterans are helping out, and one of them in particular is a Northwest Indiana veteran. Chris McClanathan's with us to talk about his efforts and others of his colleagues trying to help those people who want to get out of Afghanistan to be able to do so. And Chris, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about the concerns that you have had and others I'm sure have had as well in people that you have had the opportunity to work with while you served over in Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, it's a very complicated situation right now. And, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. And unfortunately, there's a great deal of chaos in terms of, you know, reports on the ground of what exactly is going on and who's getting on these flights, because all indications from the ground are that at some point they were just literally scooping up anyone they could find, and which is fine to have, you know, to scoop up the refugees, but it also means that there were not seats for people with legitimate documents to get on the plane, if that makes sense.
I know that a lot of the problems that have come about here are because of people that you have had the opportunity and others have had the opportunity to work with while serving overseas. The interpreters in particular, these are Afghans who pretty much have put their lives on the line, just as the soldiers have done, to be able to help out the soldiers in the effort to understand what's happening at the time that they're on duty over in Afghanistan. And now, as the Americans are leaving, and I know that in particular in the information that we have is that you've talked in one particular case to a fellow named Romal, who has helped you out when you were both working together in 2011. Will you tell us a little bit about him and the ways that you've had a chance to work with him, and in turn, how it's turned into now him looking for help to get he and his family out?
Well, you know, we worked together, probably half of the days that I was over there in Afghanistan. So I was there for almost a year, and he was helping us out do translation at the gate for people entering the base, and out on convoys to talk with the local population. So at times I was working with him for 12 hours a day, every day. He was just like one of us, really.
When you work with somebody so closely, what's the experience like? Is it just as if you had somebody like another part of you, only this time it's somebody separately who understands the language and the characteristics of the people that you are around at the time, and certainly the traditions of life in Afghanistan?
Exactly. You know, they, like the interpreters, they weren't just like, translate this document.
Right.
You know, they were giving us an insight into the culture and really helping us navigate, because, you know, their culture is very different from ours, and we want to be as respectful as we can. And they were really helpful in facilitating that and making sure that what we were trying to communicate was really getting across.
Now, you were deployed to northern Afghanistan back in 2011, and I guess you've stayed in touch over the years, but come 2021 now, how did the turn out that you have this all of a sudden contact with him and with his family?
Well, I mean, you know, we kind of, you know, sometimes you fall out of touch, and, you know, on and off, we were friends on Facebook, kind of liking each other's posts, and, you know, for a while as we did our thing, and then when the whole evacuation effort kicked off and the Taliban started taking cities, I reached out to him because he was on my mind at the time. So I reached out via Facebook and said, "Hey, are you okay?" And he said that he was safe for now, but he was scared for what was going to happen and that he needed my help. So that's kind of where it all started.
How long ago has it been since you finally got this very frantic set of conversations with him?
It's going on 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks now that I've been kind of working pretty much full time in this effort.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing that you know that the contacts have certainly, it shows that how close a friendship, even if it's just a professional relationship, like in this case, a soldier and a interpreter. You know, you're figuring you're not talking about a you know, much more personal than that, but it really is, because he's so much a part of you. He's helping he's helping keep you alive, and you're helping him stay alive too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, it's definitely not just a professional relationship. You know, he became as much of a brother to us as our fellow service members. You know, when you're over there in that kind of situation, you have to know that the person next to you has your back 100% no matter what, or the whole thing just falls apart. And so those interpreters who really put their lives on the line for us really, really just meshed in there, especially because they didn't have weapons. So they were completely dependent upon us for their protection. And that creates a really strong bond that doesn't go away after years of no contact. You know, you can just pick up like it was, exactly like it happened 5 minutes ago.
You've given us an idea of certainly the concerns in trying to help a fellow soldier in a way, although he's not with the U.S. Army. He's a fellow who's interpreting for the U.S. Army in that particular role. In trying to help get him and his family out, what's been the procedure, I guess, or the technique that you have used up to this point in trying to lobby the U.S. government to get him out of Kabul and to the United States?
I mean, basically what it's been is I've been reaching out to every contact I can, getting in contact with congressional offices, and there's been quite a few congressional staffers who have been working extremely hard to try and get these documents over to the State Department and to try and get them on a list for evacuation. But unfortunately, there's just so much bureaucracy that gets in the way of this kind of thing that it makes it really difficult to really reach someone.
I imagine this is going to be a situation that's going to continue on, even though we know we're just hours away from the end of at least the scheduled end for the evacuation of Americans from Afghanistan and from Kabul in particular. This is going to continue on past that point, I'm sure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, we have a thing in the military, and we take it very seriously, is we don't leave people behind, no mm-hmm. matter what. And that includes our allies. So while some of our leadership may have forgotten that, the rest of us have not.
Chris McClanahan is a U.S. Army veteran. He served and was deployed to northern Afghanistan back in 2011. He worked very closely with a man named Romal, who's an outgoing and a very effective interpreter while he was serving his time over in Afghanistan. And now he's doing his best, along with other veterans, trying to do the same for other people from Afghanistan to get them out of Afghanistan and their family members and to the United States or someplace safer for them to live as the Taliban have taken over Afghanistan. Chris, thank you very much for spending time with us. We'll check back with you, and let's hope that at least the rest of the days ahead will work out well for everybody.
Thank you. I hope I have good news to share with you soon.
I recorded our conversation yesterday morning, and it shows just how much it can happen in less than 24 hours. U.S. troops have moved out of Afghanistan. They finished their evacuation by the stroke of midnight Kabul time, and there's still many, many people, including Americans, that have been left behind in Afghanistan. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
As a history major, I know that we learn from the past to build a future, and to not acknowledge our history, whether it be family, just strictly family, whether it be social, whether it be business or economics, coming together for a common good and a common goal could make a huge difference in this area. The city of Valparaiso, the city of Crown Point, the towns of Munster and Maryville all have a responsibility to Gary. So many of these communities have grown as a result of what happened in Gary some years ago. And there should be an allegiance to Gary to build it up and make it prosper once again. Every community, a South Bend supports the Michiana area. Fort Wayne supports Northeast Indiana. Lafayette, Elkhart, Evansville, many others, they all have a city recognition. I'm not all that in favor of Northwest Indiana. I think it should be the Gary area. I'm disappointed that the newspapers no longer carry the tag Gary Times or Gary Post Tribune. What's a Northwest Indiana? Well, it's just a huge conglomeration of people and businesses that are trying to survive. Whereas if they had a Gary perspective, they would have a relationship to something beyond themselves. I think we're still too much focused on race and segregation. I really believe that. I think the black economic culture is perceived to be poverty. It's perceived to be indigent. And that's not really totally true. There are successful black people, and rightly so. The economics of the African-American culture is not the same as the economics of the white culture. And yet there's a need, and it could be a real appreciation if the two economic societies would come together and support and learn from one another. And when in doing so, I really believe that once Gary starts prospering again, the whole area will just come alive and be a major economic and social force in Indiana and the nation.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Two Gary residents are going to federal court in Hammond to remove state control of the Gary Community School Corporation and return it to local elected official control. With us to talk more about this 18-page lawsuit that's been filed in court, we have attorney Tracy Coleman and the two ladies who were referred to moments ago who are involved in the matter, Lorona Carter and Nikki Bird. And ladies, thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Ms. Coleman, if you will start things off and tell us more about the lawsuit itself that's been filed in federal court and the reasoning behind it.
Yes. Well, first, Ms. Carter and Ms. Bird, it's a pleasure representing them because any American citizen, if you're not being treated fairly and you feel your rights are being violated, you definitely have the right to go to court to seek justice and fairness. And so with the lawsuit filed, Ms. Bird and Ms. Carter, they're very concerned with what's going on in Gary, the treatment of our children and of our citizens. So basically, you have a lawsuit in federal court which lists out what's going on in Gary and also the violations of rights with free speech, taxation without representation, and other issues that my clients are concerned about.
Does this go back to the question of how that the school corporation itself was handled when I guess it has financial problems, and many school corporations are dealing with financial problems and have for some time, but it seems very few had the extent of financial problems that Gary and I guess to a certain point the school district in Muncie had. And those were the two I know was that the state of Indiana, I guess through first the legislature and then finally through Distressed Unit Appeals Board decided to take the matter and turn over the control from the local control over to state.
And if you look at the differences between how Muncie was treated versus Gary, you have Muncie now that's out of takeover. Mm-hmm. But you have Gary citizens that are still under takeover. And unlike Muncie, they've lost the governing body. And an important part of democracy is that you want to have checks and balances and transparency. So when things are being done, things are being decided, citizens have the right to see who's voting on this stuff. So in Muncie, they kept the governing body. In Gary, you lost the governing body. And on top of losing the governing body, you're now forced to pay additional taxes. So those issues are concerning, and that's why they're before the federal court, because Ms. Carter and Ms. Bird have a right to seek justice, equal protection under the law, and a protection of their First Amendment rights. And even if you look at the statute that we're asking to be declared unconstitutional, so in Gary, if you have an issue with something an emergency manager does, you have to get 250 signatures. And that's a prior restraint with free speech. So basically now you're putting somebody over all these citizens who live in Gary. And in order to disagree and seek some type of justice, you basically have to find 250 people to sign a petition to disagree, which is unfair and unconstitutional.
Now, Lorona and Nikki, I understand that it, on a more personal basis, that this lawsuit involves, here again, your free speech rights, that you didn't have a chance to be able to speak out to the Stress Unit Appeals Board or any of the other people that may have brought this matter of the referendum up before it was put on the ballot.
No, we did not. But not only that, I have been to one of the meetings that DUAB held. And they made it clear, even though I was present at the meeting, they were not accepting any comments. Meaning, we drove to Indianapolis to attend the meeting, and we still could not speak to anyone during that process.
Now, Tracy Coleman, I understand that in the lawsuit you go into more detail, and I'm sure this is part of the information that you put forth in the suit to certainly give the court the information, if they're not familiar with all of the background, that a lot of the issues that have involved the Gary Community School Corporation over the years that led to the going into debt and needing to seek funds to be able to pay for the improvements and the repairs that are such, go back to, I guess, the General Assembly, because they've, of course, created laws that in turn have made it difficult for the Gary School Corporation to even operate. The issue of charter schools and the issue about the property tax issues.
Yes, and that is so true, because part of the lawsuit, we even do a spreadsheet to show the financial problems with the Gary schools. That in 2008 and 2009, you see the school district ending with large cash balances. But then if we notice around 2012, the district is ending with like a negative $5 million. So basically, we're looking at state policies that you could just link in time to the financial demise. Because if we go way back, you could even look at the bill that allowed U.S. Steel to go from paying about $66 million in property taxes a year to about $14 million. Then you look at the charter schools. There are charter schools that failed in Gary, but the citizens in Gary can't go back to those charter schools and say, hey, can we have this $31 million back that you were able to get? And then even if you look at when the state took over Roosevelt, which was a flagship school, and not only did they take it over, they took it over when you knew the property tax caps were kicking in. So even once those tax caps hit, the citizens lost about $14 million. So instead of the state stepping in to really help and look at Gary as someone who is facing this tremendous financial downfall, they ended up making the problems worse. And even now academically, you don't see where these schools are getting better academically. You see they're getting worse. And even with Westside, where that graduation before the state takeover was like over 85%. Now it's down to about 58%. So eventually there comes a point that we will hope government will understand that the people who live in Gary, even though they're residents of Gary, they're citizens of Indiana, they're citizens of America. And the children who go to Gary schools, even though they're residents of Gary, these are citizens of our state, citizens of our country, and our state, instead of being punitive, that you're going to punish a community because of economic problems, they should be part of the solution. And that's where, at this point, Ms. Byrd and Ms. Carter, they love the children in this community. They have a heart to this community. They're seeking a federal judge to look at our Constitution and give justice to not only them, but also the children of this community and the citizens.
Now, do you hope that the judge, after reviewing all of this information that's in the lawsuit, can make any changes? Can they bring things back to normal and basically enjoin the state of Indiana, the state government that made the changes, that decided to turn the operation of the Gary Community School Corporation over to another company, a private company, to be able to handle this matter and switch it back so that there's a either an elected school board or at least there's a duly elected advisory committee to take over local control.
And that's where it's going to be important when we litigate these issues in federal court, because it becomes a matter of what does the Constitution say. Either the residents who live in Gary are entitled to the same protection of the law as any other citizen in the state, or, and that's where we're seeking a declaratory judgment, because there comes a point when you have rights being violated, sometimes people just have to see it on paper. Because here you have Ms. Byrd, Ms. Carter, bringing these issues to the attention, going to meetings, spending their time to just let out announcements that this is going on. But even with their passion, their dedication, you have people in leadership, they're just not hearing it. And that's where when you go to court and places like federal court, where you have this stuff on paper, you have, this is what free speech looks like. And then you have this statute which says that Ms. Byrd and Ms. Carter have to get 250 signatures to even disagree. There comes a point. This is not what our government should represent. This isn't what the Constitution should mean when it comes to free speech. So once hopefully we get these declaratory judgments, the legislators, when they're in session, they can start realizing that what happened in Gary was wrong. You don't punish American citizens because of economic problems, because it becomes an abuse of power, it becomes an abuse of authority, and then when we see the results, things don't get better for our children, they get worse. And that's what my clients are bringing to the forefront and seeking justice and equity to solve.
That's Gary attorney Tracy Coleman, who has filed the lawsuit in federal court in Hammond on behalf of Lorona Carter and Nikki Byrd. They are suing the state of Indiana, basically the state's Stressed Unit Appeals Board, and certainly the election process by way of the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration, about putting the 2020 $72.1 million 8-year referendum on the ballot for voters in Gary to act upon, when it should remain in school local district control rather than state control. Ladies, thank you for being with us to talk about the lawsuit and see how the legal process does. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up tomorrow, we have a conversation with Valparaiso's Mayor Matt Murphy. We hope you can join us for that.